Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, kidlit notables, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner, an elementary school librarian, author of the Busy Librarian blog, and your host. This is episode number 159 with Julie Pashkis, author, illustrator, most recently of Pizanka Lays an Egg, published by Peachtree Publishers. Julie's background in folk art is apparent in the beautiful illustrations she creates, and the control and spontaneity she shows in Pizanka is a work of art. It's vibrant and wonderful. If you like what you hear, I encourage you to download other episodes of Let's Get Busy on your computer or handheld device by subscribing through your preferred podcast host like Stitcher or iTunes, or by visiting the Let's Get Busy homepage directly. Rating the podcast through stars or reviews on the Stitcher app or on iTunes actually helps the podcast reach a greater audience, which also translates to these podcast hosting tools recommending Let's Get Busy to other listeners, which is a very good thing. Definitely do that if you want to help bring these chats to even more ears. And by the way, thank you for those of you that share the podcast on Facebook or on Twitter or say all those really wonderful and nice things that you do. You are helping to connect this podcast to new ears, to new people. And in that way, I'm actually getting to meet a whole lot of other cool illustrators and authors that I think will be future guests on the podcast. They're so nice and the stuff they're creating is so wonderful that I just can't help but keep them around. So thank you. You are playing a huge role in this story that we're weaving through this podcast. So thank you. Well, it's time to start episode number 159 of the podcast with Julie Pashkis. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Julie Pashkis. I am elated to have you here to talk about your art tonight.
Well, I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
Julie, I should say off the bat, I mentioned this to you off recording, but I have seen your work. I've known your work. Being a school librarian, I've known your work for some time now. But to be able to spend time with your newest book, with Pizanka Lays an Egg, was a really, really special treat with me. And I have to say, honestly, it was one that I carried this bag around and showed a good number of my friends, library friends, and just friends from church, friends from school, just because I was so overwhelmed with the brightness of your colors, but also just the vibrant accessibility of your art was just wonderful to me.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I would love, actually, if you wouldn't mind just sharing with the listening audience the story of Pizanka Lays an Egg, and then I'd love to just be a fan after that, if you don't mind.
Sure, that sounds nice. Do you want me to say what the story of the book is,
sure,
or how the story of how the book came about?
Guess kind of both. Why don't we start with the story of what the book is first?
Pizanka Lays an Egg is a story about an unusual chicken because, as my sister says, she's the only thinking chicken. But she, all of the other chickens are sort of dutiful and they lay their eggs and they have different personalities. Some of them are friendly and warm and others are a little bit persnickety. But Pizanka doesn't do what she's supposed to do. She wanders around the the farmyard, and she just takes in things. She just looks at the world around her, and she gets under more and more pressure to lay an egg from the other chickens. And when she finally lays an egg, it contains everything that she looked at while she was wandering. It's it is a sort of reflection of her experiences. And the name Pisanka comes from Pisanki, are Ukrainian decorated eggs that are intricate and beautiful. And there's a long tradition, and I can tell you lots about the tradition if you're interested.
But
Pisanka, one egg, the singular, is Pisanka, and many eggs is Pisanki, and that's where she gets her name.
I have seen photos from maybe on your blog or from something of this sort of annual tradition you have of decorating these eggs, and that made me want to start traditions of my own in that same way.
I highly recommend that you do that. It's so fun. It's such a fun thing to do, but it's also a really nice way to visit with other people, just to do crafts side by side. You can talk and then not talk, and everyone's eggs look beautiful. They're sort of the Ukrainian, the traditional ones, there's a great deal of precision to them, but no matter how you do them, like if you just sort of drizzle wax on them and keep dyeing them, they turn out beautiful. It doesn't matter. They always work. So that's
I don't know, just doing for years or since childhood, or where does that connection start with you?
I first tried it in childhood. A friend of my mother's named Sally Kitros came over and brought a bunch of dyes, and we all did it. And I remembered how much fun it was. And then I did it again in college. And I've been doing it pretty much since then out here. And then maybe, I'm not sure how many years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, my sister started having this great big egg decorating party where she opens her house up. And it started out fairly small, but everyone who ever came wanted to come back and bring friends. So at this point, she takes the furniture out of her living room, rolls up the rug, sets out long tables. They have this huge potluck. All of the family comes from all around the country. She lives in Philadelphia, and I live in Seattle. We all come, and then all her neighbors and friends and coworkers come, and the party starts at 10 in the morning and usually winds up around midnight. It's just crazy. Really fun.
Oh my goodness! In Philadelphia, I'm close. I'm gonna have to bug your sister for an invite.
Ah, okay. Yeah, she's in North Wales, actually, outside of Philly.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, I actually, to have that tradition of sitting around and making things, of crafting things, I do have memories of when I was a child getting to sit around with the family, and that time where, well, I guess anything where you're spending time around the table and really allowing time to enjoy each other's company and to create things and to sort of lose track of time. That's special, sacred time.
It is. It's just my favorite thing.
You know, I for all that I loved Pisanka lays an egg, I have to say that the other thing that really connected and resonated with me was how it just brought back memories of another book from my childhood. That was, I wonder if you've read it too, that's Matthew's Dream by Leo Leone. The story of the mouse who kind of gathers the memories.
I don't know that dream. I think one of the, in one of the reviews, somebody mentioned that too. And I was falling on the floor with happiness to be in the same sentence as Leo Leone.
Leo?
Yeah. But I don't know that particular book, but I was lucky enough to hear Leo Leone speak one time in the early 90s at a conference on design and children in Aspen. And he was very old, and Frances, I'm blanking her last name, the really wonderful, famous editor, escorted him up to the stage, and he did a little story of mice and creativity in eight acts, and he talked for a few sentences, then turned around, and at the end he passed out construction paper, and everyone in the audience made a little collage mouse, and it was very fun.
Oh well, the notion that to me, just I always see my students in these books, but to see it as that quiet, contemplative child or person in your life, that's not to say that there isn't something going on this whole time that they appear to not be as productive as everyone around them. But really the what they produce can be beautiful and a work of art. And in this way, I think Pizanka has a literal work of art that she lays. But yeah.
Well, they say that one thing I heard about advice is that when you give advice, you're usually giving it to yourself. And I think that one of the things I was saying to myself is that not every moment has to be productive, that even when you are relaxing or stepping aside, you're feeding your creativity. And there was a quote, I think it was from Zorba the Greek, that said something like, what a strange machine man is. Into him you put, what was it, lemons and, oh, I can't even remember the other things, and out come dreams and desires. And so it was just this idea that you need to feed the creativity. It can't just all be like pedal to the metal work all the time to come out with things.
Oh, that resonates. And you know, when I guess when I think of your art too, and thinking of feeding that creativity, you know, Julie, your brush is so loose in this, and fluid and flowing, and it's beautiful. And I think the art that you've created, the curves that you have, the design that you have in this, in a lot of ways mimics the Ukrainian art on these beautiful eggs. But I just, there's something to it that I think was just beautiful to behold, looking at your art in this book. It looked, I don't know what else to say it other than I'm reading this book going, I think this artist actually had fun making this art and just left it fun on the page. It doesn't look, maybe perhaps it doesn't look over edited.
Yeah, it was incredibly fun to paint, and I was trying for it not to be labored. I mean, that was, I wanted to sort of have the lines come from my elbows and not my fingers, you know, sort of loose.
Okay.
And what I would do for set, you know, sometimes I would have to paint a page many times to get it to work. So it wasn't that I didn't work on it. It's that if the painting didn't work, I just started it again until it worked, so that the painting was fresh. I didn't labor, you know, I didn't want like lines that were caught. But if I was loose and they failed, I would just do it again. Or if the color didn't turn out what I wanted it to be, I would just do it again, because they were pretty quick. Yeah.
Huh. Well, it worked.
Well, one thing I really wanted to do that turned out not to be possible was I wanted to paint it with Ukrainian dyes instead of with watercolor or gouache.
Okay, so what are Ukrainian dyes? What's the difference here? Is it from plants?
The ones I get are made by Luba. They're called Luba's dyes, and they're the ones we actually dye the eggs with. And they're just these intense colors, like magenta and turquoise and bright blue and dark blue and pumpkin. And so I bought all the dyes, and I did painting samples with the dyes. And I told the art director that I wanted to illustrate the book using Easter egg dyes instead of paints. And it was very vivid, but we sent a sample to the printer, and the colors couldn't be reproduced with any kind of accuracy. They came out really different than the paintings. And we just thought it was not safe to sort of do the art that way, that it might come out too different from the originals. And so it was hard to give up that dream of this like crazy intense colors, but it was also, I have more control with gouache to make the colors what I want them to be.
Is that something that typically happens when the art is turned in and it gets scanned? Mm-hmm. Is there's some level of the integrity of the colors that is compromised in all art, or is that something that usually happens?
It can happen. I mean, for this book, the originals are more vivid than the reproductions. But I try not to get too bent out of shape with it, because basically nobody sees the originals except for me. So if I have a chance, in some books with some publishers and with some books, I have a chance to color correct the proofs a little bit and say, this isn't the way it was. Other times I don't have that feedback. But I try not to get really crazy about it, because I'm the only one who can know the difference. If it works in the printed form, then I'm okay with it, even if it's not exactly what I painted.
Well, that makes sense. Do you have somewhere through your blog or something like that, do you have samples of the original art with that, with the Ukrainian dyes, that even brighter colors?
I can't remember if I put one of those on the blog or not. And it's funny because when you put things on a computer, the colors look different on every single person's computer screen.
That's right. That yeah.
So there's even more variation digitally, I think.
Huh. Yeah. And just even, I don't know, the notion of the way we perceive color is interesting to me too. The way that we, when we look at something, the different colors just have different qualities of standing out to one person than they do to another. But I just, yeah, I don't know. That's a fascinating thing to me, to know that the way that the colors transfer into the computer or into the scan would change. You've got your end result here. What I'm holding is such a beautiful, vibrant book. I mean, it's a beautiful work of art, the way it came out. And you're right. None of us will ever see your originals to know the difference. But right. It is beautiful to see it.
Well, thank you. And just before we leave the topic of color, want to tell you an interesting fact I learned from the show. I think it's called Radio Lab, Jad
and Umarov.
They did an episode on color, and it was all about the differences in the way people perceive color and animals perceive color. And I found out that butterflies and also some kind of shrimp or jellyfish, some kind of thing that lives in coral reefs, both of those perceive many more colors than human beings do, which I thought was fascinating. Like, we have a certain number of cones, they have extra cones. So I think for a butterfly, maybe it's they can tell all the subtleties on a flower and know which flower to go back to.
And that in the perception of the colors in the air and in the atmosphere, I remember hearing that. I'll have to find that the archive of that and post it on here. That's a show that I am endlessly fascinated by.
I did a blog post about just color, and I'll send you the link to that. And it had the link to that radio show in it.
Your illustrations, the other work that you've done. Mm-hmm. I certainly have not read all of your other books. You've you're quite prolific. You've created so many different works, and everything has sort of a different feel to it. And I think about your work. I think I probably first connected who you were through Albert the Fix-It Man. Mm-hmm. But some of the art that stood out to me the most, I think because of your patterns, because of your design focus that way, was in Yellow Elephant. I remember Yellow Elephant and just the way that stood out. And since then, I've come to know you for that sort of textile approach. And I know also then from going onto your website that you actually do some textile design.
Well, I went to school. Before I went to college, I went to a folk high school in Norway where I did learned some Norwegian folk arts. And then I came back and I went to just a regular liberal arts college. I was at Cornell for a couple years, and I just missed doing art. And I had loved the experience of the folk high school so much that I transferred and I went to the School for American Craftsmen in Rochester, New York, where I studied weaving. And then I didn't do any textile design for years. I went on and I went back and I got a teaching certificate and I taught children's art and I did illustration. And then after Yellow Elephant was published, a local fabric person that manufactures fabric saw the book and called me up and said, "Would you like to design fabric?" And I'm like, "Well, of course I would. You know, I've been waiting for you to call me for my whole life." And so I've been designing fabric for his company ever since. And it's just been a really pleasant thing to do.
What brought you into doing art for children then, or for children's books? Was that because of that folk background? Because that, I feel like so much of that ties, the storytelling tradition ties a lot to lending itself to that art.
I think that my work is certainly informed by folk art and folk traditions. I think the desire to illustrate books and to write books came when I was a child, before anything. I mean, just from loving books so much, and they were so valued in the home I grew up in. I mean, it was every 2 weeks we went to the library and we had this special library bag that was really beautiful, and we could take as many books as we wanted out of the library. And it was just, it was sort of the cornerstone of our existence. And the pictures in the books, they imprinted on my brain. And I think that from the earliest time I can remember wanting to make books and to sort of be part of that world.
Wow. What an incredible story to have that be so resonant with you forever like that. Ah, man, our readers are so lucky to have someone like you. I actually have a question related to the way you talk to kids at school visits. And all I keep thinking now is, this is the person they're getting, someone who has these incredible, vivid memories of childhood and bringing home, like you said, as many books as you want, and having this special bag that you can remember that. My memory, and I would love to, I'll have to go back one day before they, like, tear down the library or something in Williamsport, but I remember going what felt like through corridors and skinny stairwells and, you know, loud echoing hallways down kind of underneath the main branch of this beautiful kind of marble library to the children's area. I remember that. I remember even like the little windows that looked out to really the parking lot where all you could see was people's feet walking by, things like that. But to be able to recall those stories.
And the smell of paper, probably.
Oh, gosh. You know, I should say I was just at a conference in New Hampshire, presenting at a school library conference, and John Chu, a mutual friend of mine and also the guy who runs Watch Read Connect, he's Mr. Chu online, and everyone sort of
right.
knows
I think
him.
I did a little thing with him for Pizanka as well.
I'm sure. Everyone, we all love and adore John. And John at the conference had this session that I couldn't resist going to, where he was talking about the best books of 2015 so far and some forever books. But he started off talking to his attendees by showing us the way that he and his students read a book, which is to say that the first thing they do after taking the book out of the box is that you just bury your nose right inside the book. He was talking about which publishers that his students think have the best smelling books. And imagine the way that we, when we share these stories, but also when we participate with these children, I'm sure, you know, that's something that I will have to make sure that I am doing with my son. Is just making sure you, yeah, get your nose in a good book and experience it for all of the senses that are presented in front of you.
That's great. I'd never even thought of that, but saying put your nose in a book is more than just a metaphor. It's like literal.
So I was going to ask you with the school visits that just out of a curiosity standpoint, you have new books coming out all the time, but I'm sure also there's art that you've done that has sort of informed the rest of your career and continues to influence you. So do you find, I guess the first question I want to know just out of curiosity is, how long do you find you'll talk about a given book? Is it just until, like in the pre-publication up until it comes out and then in the life before the next book comes out? Or do you find that there's still some that you are still talking about just as much today?
Well, for many years, I didn't do school visits. I paint and I show at the gallery and I do fabric and I do books. And I just, for years, well, really for most of the years when I was illustrating other people's work more than doing, illustrating books I had written, I figured that I could hide out and not have to sort of leave my studio. And, the first school visits I did were a couple years ago. I went to Idaho for a week and I did one local one here. And then last year I went to Eastern Washington for a week. And I talk about a lot of the different books for different reasons, sort of things that I hope will connect to that the kids will connect to. But yeah. I think what I really, my message to when I talk to children is that creativity is, I think the way I summed it up was that it was it's a muscle, not a bone. Like people say, I don't have a creative bone in my body. I'm thinking, it's not a bone, it's a muscle, and you have to exercise it. And it's just like any other kind of exercise. The more you do, the better you'll get. And I sort of urge on them imperfectionism, like being willing to take risks and try new things, as well as perfectionism, being willing to like work hard until you get something the way you want it. So when I'm talking to kids, I'm not really just talking about one specific book. I'm sort of talking about those ideas in general.
Yeah. Do you find that there's a balance in your own art where you do leave mistakes in as much as you do also, you know, continue to, as you're saying, like redo the art and work toward that, the perfection that you want, but also there must just be sort of these happy accidents, happy mistakes, right?
Mm-hmm. I think you can learn a lot by sort of making mistakes. And there is a sort of balance between expertise, like getting good at something, and also pushing yourself. And I think it isn't a matter of trying to leave mistakes. I can't help making mistakes. And it's sort of when I look back later, I just think, oh, my God, I can't believe I published that without fixing that. But at the time, it was the best I could do. So I'm always just sort of trying to do the best that I can do and trying to sort of keep growing and learning.
Okay, I'm going to just ask a question out of the blue. And if this seems far-fetched, just ignore it and move on. But I was talking to Mike Bolt, who's illustrated a number of great books. Most recently, I love I Don't Want to Be a Frog by Dev Petty. I don't know if you've read that book. It's wonderful.
I like the title.
Oh, it's wonderful, wonderful. But we were talking about the notion of books getting re-illustrated. Some books, I guess, publishers withhold the rights or maintain the rights, I should say. Yeah. And so they can come back, or maybe they purchase the rights again to republish them, and they can be re-illustrated. Is that something that, I don't know, in some crazy world, if they ever gave you the opportunity to re-illustrate one of your own works, would you? I mean, knowing that over time your skill develops and also changes, though, is that something that you would ever, as an artist, do you ever redo something? Or is it art for the sake of the moment that it was created?
I've never thought about that before. I think I would want to do, I don't think I'd want to do the exact same project again.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because one of the books that I've illustrated that was actually one of my favorite books that I've illustrated was a retelling of the Cinderella story that was written by Paul Fleischman. And he took the Cinderella story from 18 different countries and sort of merged into one book. And it's called Glass Slipper, Gold Sandal. Mm-hmm. And when I first did that, a friend of mine who was at the time about 6 years old, she goes, why are you doing another Cinderella? Like, and I thought, oh gosh, you know, a six-year-old's burned out on this. This is not a good sign. But then when I got into it, I sort of discovered my own way into the story, and it was really a pleasure to illustrate it. Well, it was also so beautifully written.
Oh yeah. That's we, in our elementary school, or I guess in our county, our gifted and talented group, or they have like a pullout, like a curriculum extension group. I should put it that way. The curriculum extension group in, I don't even know what grade. I want to say like second or first. It's one of the younger grades. Mm-hmm. Does this study of the Cinderella story through different cultures. Mm-hmm. And your book, as soon as that came out, I remember because it was maybe my first or second year as a librarian. And when that came out, my word, that ended up being the standard for all of the samples that we look to. Paul did such a beautiful job on that, as you did as well. That was a nice pairing.
We just have another book together in production right now that's going to come out in about a year. It's similar. It's about creation myths, and he gathered them from all around the world. And his books are, they're more work than anything else I do because they just involve huge amounts of research. And the Cinderella one involved all this research into the different countries, but the creation one, it was research. But I thought, these are the most sacred stories to each one of these cultures. I cannot get this wrong. So it was sort of terrifying, but also exhilarating. Like, you know, when you talked about sort of taking risks and trying new things, I felt that way about illustrating that book.
Yeah. I mean, when you've got a book like Glass Slipper, Gold Sandal, or this creation one you're talking about, and you bring mm-hmm. it into a school of diverse population, then there's such a strong chance that, well, in any way, that a kid will see themselves in this story. This is a tradition that I grew up on, or this mm-hmm. is a... So, yeah, the pressure, I can't imagine, but the pressure on you and on Paul yeah. to get it right, because right. you're going to see yourself in this story. And any good picture book, if there's any point in this story where, if it's a fantasy story, I mean, just like with Pizanka, if there was something that didn't seem like it fit the rules of the world you established, then you lose your readers. So even mm-hmm. more so when you're talking about their their creation stories, my mm-hmm. word. But that must have been so fun. I mean, I feel like even getting to work with someone else like that, you just learn. Yeah. I would love just the opportunity to not only to create the art for it, but just to learn about all the stories that Paul has gathered.
I think that's one reason I like to keep illustrating books by other people as well as by myself, you know, ones that I've written, is because they do take me into some other world that I wouldn't know about otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah, that, yeah. It's funny that we even bring that up, because I was going to ask that, that there is that value to getting to tell your own story the way that your art and your words can tell it together.
Mm-hmm.
But that collaboration offers so many things, not only just creating something that wouldn't have existed prior, because you're bringing your own vision of the art and that person is bringing their vision of the text, but also that you're right, you get to learn and experience a story that you may not have ever been drawn to write to begin with.
Exactly.
A wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. A wonderful thing. Well, I'm excited that you've got these things in the works, but also that there's so much to discover from the stuff you've already done, Julie. And I'm excited to lose myself even more in your art, because just everything, every new thing I find is so wonderful. I love just the perspective that you bring to the table, and the way that you're playing with color and design to entertain our eyes and to tell us stories.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I think like each of the books I do, a lot of them look really different from each other. And I think
yeah.
it's because, I mean, I hope they all are identifiable as my work, but what I'm trying to do is make the art fit the words, you know, be right for that book. And when I first get a project and I just have the manuscript, I try to sort of be a little bit of a Pizanka and wander around and sort of take things in before actually making any art, just sort of to sort of set what that particular book will look like.
Are you doing most of your art or all of your art in a physical medium as opposed to working in digital?
Definitely.
Cool.
I have, you know, I have a good scanner, I have a good computer, and I communicate with the people that I'm working with through the computer, and I send my sketches by scanning them. But all of the work I draw it by hand and I paint it by hand, and I think with my hands as much as I do with my mind. I'll have some idea in my mind, but then when I actually start drawing, it changes and evolves. And I really feel like I have wisdom in my hands as well as in my brain.
Well, I understand that people that work in digital have the tools to recreate texture and to do things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there's beautiful books done digitally,
mm-hmm.
but there's something about looking at your art, it's just from the books that I know, and the ones that I will love when I get to see them, that it's just, there's something that feels physical about them, that feels like you could touch the page, that feels like it came from something, that it could
mm-hmm.
exist, that I could go into your house and see drafts lying around on a table of different sketches that turned into what we see now. It feels like that, so that it makes sense.
Yeah.
To know that that's what it is then.
It is true. It's it can get kind of thick on the ground with sketches.
How do you ever then get rid of them? Do you just gift them to people, or do you have a way of storing them all?
I don't keep all of my sketches.
No,
I keep,
you can possibly.
I keep some of them.
Have you kept all the original art then? Because then that means you actually have original art, which is a weird concept in those people that I've spoken to that work in digital, is that
mm-hmm.
they don't really have original art.
I've kept some of it and I've sold some of it.
Oh, yeah.
I do both.
Yeah, that makes sense. Beautiful. Well, I'm thankful that your art is out in the world and that we have new books from you. Pisanka Lays an Egg, as I mentioned before, is wonderful. I think it's a work of art, and I think it's a story that I'm going to treasure. We're going to treasure around our house for a very long time. And I certainly am not the only person that loves a good picture book. So I'm thankful that it's out there, Julie.
Well, thank you.
Oh, of course. Of course. Please. Totally my pleasure. I love that we get to be in this fun world where you get to do when you do the thing that you love, when you are at your best, it creates then something for us to love as well. And that's just a wonderful communal experience that we get to have with picture books.
I remember when I think it was the third book I illustrated. Was it the third? So, you know, very early on, I illustrated a book by John McCutcheon. It was called Happy Adoption Day, and it was sort of a happy birthday song for kids that were adopted. And it was really fun to illustrate. And I had someone come up to me and say, you know, this made such a huge difference in my child's life. And that this book came out, and I thought, wow, you mean I can actually do the thing that gives me the most pleasure and it will be a good thing in the world? It just felt like I couldn't even believe my good fortune that it would work out that way. So,
well, I hope that fortune continues to bless you, because it's all good for us. It's very selfishly, the more it benefits you, the more it benefits us. Hey, Julie, before I let you go, I'm going to ask you one more question.
Okay.
That always feels like now it's coming out of left field, perhaps literally, but it is such a question that offers the opportunity to just love on the people that have inspired you. So I'm assembling an all-star kid-lit dream team kickball tournament, and Julie, I'd love to know what one person alive or past from the kid-lit world you'd want on your team and why.
Well, I'm going to nominate Virginia Lee Burton to be on the team.
Oh, what a great name.
She wrote and illustrated Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel and Katie and Little House. And I think it was in the 40s or 50s. I'm not sure. But she is an icon to me, because not only did she do these wonderful books, but she also lived this really full and creative life. She was married to a sculptor, and they had wild parties where she would dance on the tables. And then she had a community, and with other, I think it was mainly other women, they produced fabric, which they printed by hand. And it was called Folly Cove Designers. It was kind of an artist community craft thing. There's a great documentary about her that tells all about it. And I love the way I love the books she made, but I also love the way she lived her life. Oh, and I think if she can dance on tables, she'd be good at kicking balls too.
I like the way you think, Julie. I like the way you think. Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much again for coming on. And I look forward to all that is to come in publishing from you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I'll enjoy reading your blog and listening to it, and I will keep doing that.
Like what you hear? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Leave a comment on the blog at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com, or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's Koko Sleep, and I'll see you there.